Imagine you're struggling with back pain for months. No one can tell you what's wrong. Then you find a doctor.
And the words that he said that I wanted to hear was, I can fix you. And, you know, those are magic words. I was in pain, and somebody, a neurosurgeon, said, I can fix you.
You trust he'll take care of your problem.
Nothing but good reports and a list of accolades that were 2 pages long.
When you talk to him, he's engaging. He seems very intelligent. He's witty. He's charming.
He'd always talk about, I'm going to be a doctor.
But he has this dark side that he likes to keep separate and hidden from everybody else.
This is a story about 33 patients who put their trust in a prominent surgeon in Dallas.
State your full name for the record.
Christopher Daniel Dunch.
And wish they hadn't.
In commercials, Dr. Christopher Dunch calls himself the best neurosurgeon in all of Dallas. He specializes in relieving back and neck pain.
Then they come back to me to discuss surgical options.
But these folks couldn't disagree more. They say he's a butcher and a drug addict who maimed them during surgery.
Oh, it feels like somebody has an ice pick planted squarely in my back.
Lee Passmore says he never had crippling nerve spasms until Dr. Dunch needlessly removed part of his spine during a procedure to relieve back pain.
I shouldn't be this way. I'm sorry.
According to Passmore's attorney, Dr. Dunch had a serious drug problem since he was a resident.
There is one report that he spent an entire night doing cocaine at a party. And then when the sun came up, put on his scrubs and went off to the hospital to treat children.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer, producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And, you know, the case that we're going to cover today gave me such a severe flashback to when I was 11 and I had some very severe back pain and I was diagnosed with some severe scoliosis. And we had to talk to many different doctors and some of them wanted to cut me open and put metal rods in my back. And others said, don't do it. Don't ever take that chance. And I just got to thinking of how many people in my life have debilitating back pain and want relief. I'm sure many of our listeners do. You'll do almost anything to get rid of that pain. It can just so impact your quality of life. And this offender that we're going to speak about took advantage of those people and promised that he could help them. It turns out, and I think he had just much darker intentions to intentionally hurt them. And of course, we're talking about, Jim, what case is this?
This is Wondery's Dr. Death, Season 1, the case of Dr. Christopher Dunch. And of course, we here at Real Crime Profile are going to remove the doctor, and we're just going to call him Dunch. And this guy, who should have been a public servant, who should have been helping people with their terrible back pain, actually caused horrific outcomes. 33 patients dead or maimed. 33 patients. And he just kept going and going and going until he was stopped. So this is somebody who had no business being a doctor.
So just for our listeners, before we dive in any deeper, this is Wondery's 6-part podcast, Dr. Death, Season 1, where there has also been an update. So I highly recommend that you all listen to Dr. Death Season 1. So many people listened to it in the first instance. We deep dived it again, and many of you might be interested to know that there's also a TV series being made. And that TV series, well, it's been delayed a little bit, but it was going to star Jamie Dornan. It's now going to star Dawson's Creek Joshua Jackson, and I think it's going to be very well done. It's going to be 2021 when it's released, so you're going to see this brought to the TV screen. And again, it's just another horrific case of somebody who, as Jim said, got away with it time and time again, who wasn't brought to account, and there's a question mark about what's going to happen next in the case. It's still ongoing. So why I say that is because it must just be agonizing for all the victims. First of all, to have their voices heard, as Lisa said in the opening, when you put your trust in doctors, and when something goes wrong, you think that it just went wrong in good faith. And then when you find out that it didn't, and that maybe someone tried to intentionally harm you and you're one of a number, that's when I tend to see people wanting to get justice, when they band together. But there are many out there who still haven't had justice for what he did.
Right.
Really, really problematic.
Yeah, and speaking of numbers, when you're talking about serial offenders, there is a congressional statute that says that to be named a serial killer, which gives the FBI primary jurisdiction in a case, along with the local jurisdictions, because they cover murder statutes, you'd have to have three or more murders in separate events. But at the Behavioral Analysis Unit, we always looked at serial murder as more of a qualitative analysis rather than just a quantitative analysis. It's the kind of person and the reasons and the motivations and the methodologies and the victimology that makes a serial offender a serial offender. And so in the BAU, we always said that if someone killed two or more people in separate instances, separate events, that they are already a serial killer. And in this case, Dunch killed two people and seriously injured and maimed 31 other patients. So these are 33 of his patients who all trusted him and wanted relief from pain and suffering and immobility. And instead, they got paralyzed and suffered horrendous, just terrible, terrible outcomes. And two of them died. So even though he claimed that he was this talented surgeon and boasted to his patients and even his friends that he could help them with their back pain, in fact, what he did was just maim people, just butcher them. And it's just horrific.
So Jim, at New Scotland Yard, we had a serial killer group, and we originally did adopt the FBI's definition of a serial killer. And then we decided to amend it so that if we had somebody who had killed one person, and let's say there was a near miss, another offence that we know they committed, and yet through medical science, somebody survives, we would still include that case.
Right, smart.
Because, yeah, these near misses that happen, of course, we know medical science can be an incredible thing that actually keeps people alive. But this case is all about the intention, isn't it? What was the intention? Did this individual mean to commit serious harm? And that's a question mark as we go through this case. Or was it something that was just unfortunate, as some people say, well, with neurosurgery, it's like dancing on a razor blade. It can go either way, and therefore it's a risky business anyway. And I think that's probably the question that we are going to answer. But of course, a lot of the times in our work, Jim, we see very clearly that there's motivation and intention to harm.
Yeah, because the first time something happens like this, it's a tragedy. And the second time, it's a double tragedy. When it happens the third time and the fifth time and the ninth time and the 12th time and the 22nd time and the 30th time and the 31st and the 32nd, is it an accident on the 33rd time? Absolutely not. It wasn't an accident on the third time. Somebody who does this and deliberately continues this kind of behavior, there's a point at which it's potentially accidental. There's a point where it's deliberately reckless. And that's the point where you go from non-crime or questionable crime to absolutely known crime. Because if somebody is doing these things, even if everything else is perfect and they have this outcome, they have to stop doing it. If every time you drove a car, you ran over a person and you either maimed them or killed them, you stop driving a car. You realize you're not capable of doing it safely. Well, this guy took a blade and cut people's backs open and did horrific things inside, maimed them. And even when all the signs were pointing towards this person is in distress, didn't even want to consider that he made a mistake or did something wrong, and therefore just said, ah, don't worry about it, closed her up, and there she goes.
She's gone. Right. And everybody in those operating rooms with him knew that there was something wrong. The nurses, the medical techs, showing him that he's left a screw in somebody's muscle, showing him that he's in the at the wrong placement, he's working on the wrong disc, and he just will not, he will not listen to anyone, and they have to end up calling in other doctors to repair his work. But I think what Laura Beale gets to in the Wondery podcast, and she takes you through all these victims so well, is that it's he's allowed to do this because the medical board won't do anything to stop him, no matter how many doctors complain.
Right. And I think that's, we need to go back to the beginning of him and medical school, because in medical school, the medical board got all the information they needed to know. And that was that he had to go to rehab during medical school because he was hooked on drugs. He was abusing drugs and seriously avoiding any kind of actual responsibility for his behavior. So it's one thing if you get hooked on drugs because you're taking medicine to keep awake, or, you know, uppers or speed or whatever to keep awake so you could keep up with the grueling schedule, and you kind of get hooked on that stuff, and so then it's found out and you mea culpa and you get treatment and then you try to stop it. But when you actually embrace it, when you actually are unapologetic and you actually keep going and doing the same thing over and over again, and they graduate you from medical school, and then just by a confluence of events, a particular need, a particular series of events where he ended up in a position where now he's doing surgeries that he really doesn't have the experience for. But because he's so arrogant, because he's so narcissistic, because he can't ever even consider that he is incapable of something, he just barrels through and destroys people's lives.
Yeah, that's the alarming part. You mentioned a confluence of things, but actually, let's not forget, he was kicked out because of his drug taking. You know, to do neurosurgery, you've got to be on your game, or anything to do with the brain, you've got to be 100% on your game. And his partner saw he had cocaine and was partying, didn't even try and hide it. I think that's the interesting part. He doesn't try and hide it. He just says, stay out of my business, as if it's perfectly acceptable to be so reckless doing the work that he's doing. And it's the sheer arrogance, actually, outrageous levels of arrogance and confidence. And, you know, people described him as driven. And I wrote down the word driven, and then I wrote all the other things that I thought were his characteristics from listening to Laura Beale and others who knew him the best. And of course, back in college, his friends said he was volatile. Now, volatile is not a characteristic you want. You're a neurosurgeon about to do, you know, complex surgery. But that driven aspect, it's great to be committed, it's great to be determined, but this wasn't about being driven. This was about being arrogant and entitled and delusional. That when he lost his job, maybe the lab work he was much better suited to, but then he decides, well, what's he going to do? I know what I can do, even though I haven't had enough surgeries and been supervised, but I'm still going to open people up because I'm going to make money from it. And was it as simple as that? I don't think it was, by the way. But I think that the way they characterized it in the Wondery podcast to begin with is it was a simple transition from, okay, I've been stopped from doing lab work, therefore I'm going to do neurosurgery to make money. But I think it was much more about his ongoing God complex.
The power.
The power and control that he wanted over people.
This once prominent neurosurgeon will spend the rest of his life behind bars.
Confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for life.
The charge, intentionally maiming patients.
A medical license does not keep you from prosecution if you maim and kill people.
Emotions ran high outside court following the life sentence.
This will not bring my mother back. But it is some sense of justice for all of the families, for all of the victims.
Caitlin Lanuff's mother, Kelly Martin, bled to death during back surgery performed by Dr. Christopher Dunch, who in TV commercials billed himself as the finest neurosurgeon in Dallas.
I mean, a lot of doctors are driven and are, you know, type A personalities and think that they know everything. And you want a doctor who does know everything. So, but what do you think the difference is with this guy?
Well, I think like Laura was saying, and like I was alluding to earlier, remember, this is 33 different patients that he maimed or killed in 24 months, 2 years. So month after month, patient after patient, disastrous result after disastrous result, he kept on going. Why? Because he liked it. Because he was getting something that he wanted, some need satisfied in him. And that's either the adulation that he gets from patients looking up to him, or it's the power to get inside and do what should be work that is so delicate, so surgical in nature, that only a few people have the talent to do it on this planet. But he wanted to feel that way despite the fact that he didn't have those talents. He wanted to feel that way despite the fact that he drugged his way through medical school. He wanted to feel that way despite the fact that patient after patient after patient was ruined by him, and until he started killing people.
I think you mentioned a very important word, which is detailed. And what we know about his behavior and his personality from his friends at college was that he wasn't a detailed person. He would get lost. He kept damaging his car. He kept leaving his keys in places that actually his flatmates realized he always left them in the door. But his attention to detail was missing. And I think what we need to do with someone like Dunch is go right back to the beginning of where he came from and the environment that he came from. And one of his good friends said that he would no way trust him to operate on him because he'd probably end up leaving something inside of him and stitching him back up. And of course, we know that's exactly
what he did.
Right. I mean, it was a false statement because that's exactly
unbelievable.
So the people who knew him best already called it. The problem was, I think, with Jerry Summers, one of his good friends, which is such a haunting case because they were friends and because Jerry had worked with him and done so much to clear up all his messes in school, was that he then decides he's going to operate on his friend Jerry, even though Jerry didn't have a major injury. And that in and of itself just screams of a callous disregard when he clearly has had botched surgeries before Jerry. And actually, just one point to make about that is I did struggle a little bit with the timeline in the Wandery Dr. Death podcast. It's quite hard to chronologically map out his, I'm going to call it, career in inverted commas, of which victim came where, and because it goes forward and then it takes you back. But I believe there were quite a few people who he had maimed and seriously harmed before Jerry, and then he decides to operate on Jerry, which to me just speaks of this callous disregard even for his friends, which is really alarming. So again, when I saw this word driven, or I heard this word driven, I just wrote all the characteristics that I thought that he was, from volatile to delusional to entitled, being arrogant, alcohol and drug induced, overconfident, abusive, lacking in empathy, lacking in compassion, hedonistic, selfish and callous disregard was what I had in there. Which actually, Lisa, when you ask the question, what you tend to see with most doctors, why they join the profession is because they want to help people. And although they may be arrogant at times, they tend to still have empathy and compassion. And that's what I felt was missing in the friends' descriptions of him and in his demeanor and the way that he treated people, and in particular opening up Jerry and having such serious consequences that Jerry's now quadriplegic. And it broke my heart listening to episode 2. I don't know how you both felt about that, but I think it's a very telling insight and very instructive about Christopher Dunch.
That particular victim really hit me hard. And especially, I mean, As a doctor, you're really not advised to ever operate or treat a family member or a friend, you know, for any number of reasons. But yeah, Jerry, his friend who, you know, he did everything for Dunch, and to turn him into a quadriplegic is really tragic. And then Laura, I thought of you later, and not to victim blame, but later when Jerry's girlfriend is talking about the man he became after this surgery, that he would hurt her, and he was so full of rage and he would take it out on her. I mean, even though he was in a wheelchair, he would smash into, I mean,
it's terrible. You know, it's a tragedy. And you can understand how frustrating that must be to go from a fully functioning man to someone who's now confined to a wheelchair and completely dependent on other people. It's, and for no good reason. It's not even that, you know, an accident happened. It's that a man who claimed to be this brilliant surgeon was hiding the fact that time after time after time, he was hurting his patients, destroying their backs, and to the point where he actually killed some of them. That's just, it's just horrible. And it must be, it would just be so hard to be able to just live life knowing that your friend did this to you, and that he knew that he had no reason to open you up. This is just, it's just horrible.
One thing for surgery to go horribly wrong, but at no point did Dunch ever apologize to his friend who had always supported him, to face him down and actually say, I got this wrong, I'm sorry.
Right, and there was a number of patients, Jeffrey Gladwell, where he said, Dunch said, well, during his case, there was difficulty. Not I did something wrong or I made a mistake. There was difficulty. And the hospital moved him, so he didn't have the opportunity to follow up with him. So it's projecting the blame. And then with Jeffrey Jamie, it was a difficult surgery. When he woke up, he had some neurological deficits that are hard to explain. Again, no responsibility at all. Not being responsible and not taking responsibility. And then with Jennifer, he said there was abnormal bleeding and had to move screws because the bone was very vascular. Not, I put the damn screws in the wrong place. Not, I should have known this before I did it. Not, I should have been capable before I opened this person up and subjected her to just horrific behavior. None of that. He just does not take any blame for it. And then when I was closing Miss Eford, it went well, no problem. But there was another patient that was dying that he had to deal with, and the hospital got scared and moved her to a different hospital. Not, I didn't do what I was supposed to do. And when I was pretending to do what I was supposed to do, I obviously caused a tremendous amount of damage to her. And I just kind of wanted to literally sweep it under the rug, having her closed up and said goodbye, went off to something else.
What do you both think about the fact that when another doctor, Dr. Henderson, looked at the surgery plan for Mary Eford, that all checked out? But when he looked at the actual work, it's like Dunch deliberately did things wrong, deliberately caused more damage, in fact, removed all of her nerves. So that there was no way that she could ever walk again. She came in on her own two feet, and that there was no way after he worked on her that she'd ever walk again. I mean, how does he go from having a plan that he's going to follow to just, it's like deliberately, I can't even explain it.
Sabotaging?
Yes.
Well, it could be, but of course you don't know who wrote the plan. And there was a suggestion that maybe Kimberly was doing far more, and or others might be doing those things. But I think Dr. Robert Henderson's quote was, it was an unmitigated atrocity.
Yeah.
That's a very serious thing for another surgeon, experienced surgeon, to say, an unmitigated atrocity. And he's an incompetent surgeon that was anatomically uneducated. He didn't know where certain parts of the body were. I mean, it's so mind-blowing to me.
It's egregious. And that just goes back to, again, while he's in medical school, he's getting high, he's getting drunk, he's abusing drugs. How could you expect to actually learn during that process? And then when you get caught and when you don't actually address the underlying issues and you just plow through and continue to do that kind of behavior. Again, it goes beyond recklessness. Now it is knowing and intentional. He picked up that scalpel intentionally. He didn't just fall on somebody with a scalpel in his hand accidentally. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly how he was misportraying his skills and abilities. And he definitely was on notice time after time after time that he didn't know what the fuck he was doing and that anybody who was on that operating table in front of him was going to be at risk with losing their ability to walk or feel or even breathe.
And also just the context, if we remember, before Mary's surgery, he'd operated on Floella Brown. Now, she was already, had lost consciousness, and Dunch was paged and told that his patient had lost consciousness, and he just disappeared. He didn't even go and see her. That, I find, just absolutely staggering. And with Floella unconscious and seriously ill, dying, he then decides to go ahead and operate on Mary. So I can't tell you, Lisa, in between, you know, maybe writing a plan or what else was going on. But when someone disappears, they go off the grid. You know, what was he doing? Was he partying? Was he out doing drugs? Was he drinking? Then he comes into the operating room. And we know even after Mary's surgery, he disappeared again. And then when he did reappear, he looked terrible. He had a hole in his scrubs that one of the nurses had noticed. He was wearing the same scrubs for 3 days. He was wearing no underwear and he hadn't showered or changed. And obviously sterility is key, as we talked about in our last episode. So I think we've got to put ourselves back in that context. It's not like someone who is going in to do surgery is clean, well-presented, is on their game. It sounds to me like he was partying, doing drugs and getting out of his mind, not showering, not changing, not looking after even the basic hygiene standards. And it's then someone should have been raising the alarm about his behavior before that surgery.
Right. And go ahead.
I was just going to ask you real quick, if either of you know, do doctors have a turnaround limit the way that pilots do? So a pilot does a transatlantic flight. They can't just turn right around and jump on a plane and do another one. And in this case, Dunch did Floella Brown's surgery and it was going so badly, but it was a long surgery. And then he turns right around and jumps into the operating room with Mary Eford. It seemed like from the podcast that the people around him thought that was very strange and that he shouldn't have had such a quick turnaround.
Well, I think they're just left to their own devices in terms of, you know, there may be hospital policies. I don't think there are any generalized policies that say you can't turn around and do surgery because they're there to save people's lives. You know, and that's, it's just, you know, it's unreasonable to do that and it's reckless to do that. But it's also, when you put that on top of the history of his failures before that, you know, it's very deliberate to me. But when we talk about, you know, Laura, you say he might have been out partying and so forth. He was wearing the same scrubs 3 days and there was holes in them and so forth. Tell me if this sounds familiar to you. He said, on the issue of drug and alcohol abuse, in the first 22 years of my career, it never came up once. Not, I never did drugs. I never abused drugs or alcohol. It's like, it's so much like Woody Allen when his daughter said that he sexually abused her. He said, in all those years of marriage, it never once came up that I could have abused a child. Not a denial of ever abusing a child. Who cares if it comes up or not? That's not the issue. The issue is, did you do it or did you not do it? And so he's revealing so much by saying, nobody ever raised the issue. Okay, Bill Cosby, nobody ever raised the issue that you were drugging women and raping them. But did that mean that you didn't drug and rape them? Absolutely not. And eventually you actually admitted it when you thought you were protected. And this guy doesn't admit it. He completely is passive. Anytime he talks about any of the bad things he does, it's 100% passive voice. And all that's doing is telling me the man is incapable of taking responsibility for his own actions.
Which again is a psychopathic trait. But I think if he made that statement, of course, it's a lie. because it did come up many, many times.
Of course.
Others did question him. Even his partner at Dysgenics, was it called, and you know, the lab work they were doing, he did question why there were drugs. And a previous girlfriend talked about his cocaine and all the parties that he went to, and each room had a different drug in it. And he would go to the hospital, he'd check in on a patient, and then he'd go straight back to the party. So we know that that was a problem. And by the way, Dr. Harold Shipman, who I spoke about when we were talking about FATA, Dr. Death Season 2, he also abused drugs. His was prescription drugs. He would write his own prescriptions, Dermeril and others. So again, we're seeing patterns emerge here. And I think that's a very important part to these cases. We're not talking about an isolated incident. We're talking about patterned behavior
right
across a long period of time.
Right. And what does that do? It starts to give us information that we can use to formulate a motive. And if you're talking about somebody who has a decidedly obvious God complex, he feels he's better than all people and feels he can play God, and no human empathy and takes no responsibility for his incredibly damaging actions, yet he keeps doing it. In my mind, this is an example of sublimation, and that he has found a profession that will help him act out these inner desires that he has to hurt people, to take away their freedoms, their life and their livelihoods, and their pain-free living. That's something that must have satisfied this inner need in him for him to have continued to do it. Any rational, normal human being who was in this position after one or two or three people that he operated on were seriously injured or maimed, when your colleagues are telling you that you're working on the wrong thing, you're doing it the wrong way, you're not following protocols, any rational person would step back, try to reevaluate what's going on, to try to prevent this from happening in the future. And he did the exact opposite. He barreled ahead forward, like you said, doing two surgeries, long surgeries back to back, after maiming one and just keeping going and then killing the next. I mean, it's unbelievable.
The real sucker punch is yet to come. This heartbreaking testimony from an unbelievable source.
Is this difficult for you to talk about?
Yeah.
I will say that Jerry's surgery was catastrophic. I mean, it was a mess. And Jerry's injuries, he has the worst possible scenario.
Jerry Summers was Dunch's best friend. Today, he is so crippled, it's difficult for him to go anywhere. Prosecutors make special arrangements for him to testify from his home as another victim of the doctor's bungled surgery.
First thing I remember is not being able to move, and I just was kind of freaking out.
He started bleeding profusely. And so the defendant started packing in gel foam, which is like a coagulant, helps stop bleeding. And he packed so much in on the spinal canal that it basically caused a spinal cord injury and put compression on the spinal canal. And that's what basically cut off, you know, the feeling from here down.
Just feels like your body weighs about, you know, 10,000 pounds and you can't pick it up. And
could you move anything?
My head.
And when was the last time Dunch reached out to his former friend, the one he reduced to spending his life in a wheelchair?
A couple of years, a year or two.
Jerry lives with paralysis and constant pain.
What do you both think of that text that he sent to his girlfriend, that he's something between God, Einstein, and the Antichrist, and he could become a cold-blooded killer? I mean, is that premeditation in your eyes? I mean, what is it, leakage? What is that?
Yeah, it's leakage, it's arrogance, it's ignorance, and it is exactly, I mean, it's him self-describing, it's him actually admitting that he knows what he's doing. He's not delusional. This is not somebody who suffers from delusions that he's doing good. He's very much aware of what he's doing. And that statement just bears it out.
So let's add a context to that, as I always love a context. Kimberly was his assistant who he was having an affair with. So he was already in a relationship, a long-standing relationship with Wendy, and she was 5 months pregnant.
Pregnant, right? Yeah.
So that gives us another context, doesn't it, of how he treats women, which is another very important thing. And he is sending these runaway train text messages and emails to Kimberly. And I think, Lisa, that first one that you mentioned, it clearly shows his self-aggrandizing, his flexing his muscles. But I think the way that they're quite ranty and nonsensical in parts, it's probably much, much more likely that he's on some kind of drug at that point.
Got it. You know,
I would hazard a guess that it's probably drug induced, but it's truth. I mean, it's really who he thinks he is.
And yeah, but when you say, when you say that it's drug induced, you just mean it lowered his inhibitions to tell the truth, right?
Right. That's his truth. As in, you know, with drugs and alcohol, it amplifies things. So that's what he really thinks. And he's probably trying to impress her as well. But I suspect deep down, that's really, we know that Kimberly was, infatuated is the wrong word, but had him on a pedestal, thought he was wonderful. And therefore, he had a captive audience to really feel that he was safe to tell her his secrets of who he really was. And I think the email that is very instructive and it's very important because it relates to the trial is the one that he sent saying, I'm ready to leave the love and kindness and goodness and practice that I mix with everything else that I am and become a cold-blooded killer. Now, that email is one that is really critical in the whole case because does it now talk to intent, i.e. is there a conscious shift and is he admitting to what's coming next or is it just a random train of thoughts when he's on drugs, alcohol, partying, etc.? Well, that's a question that has come up in the case multiple times and what his lawyer talked to as well. But I think it's highly unusual for someone to say something like that, but even more unusual to say it when you're in the caring profession of looking after people and you are meant to be undertaking life-saving surgery, which that context makes it even more significant. And in the context of what has actually happened, it's even more significant because people are being harmed and some doctors have opined that what he has done in those surgeries must have been intentional. It cannot have been anything else that was just purely coincidental or accidental. And I too, Jim, share the thought, you know, if you do something once or twice and you get it wrong, and I think of my own colleagues, police, doctors, people who I've worked with, even my own practice, you get something wrong, most people are horrified and most people do take a back seat and actually they lose their confidence. It does the opposite thing. You lose your confidence.
Interesting.
And you self-reflect on yourself. Some people even resign because of it. Yeah, I've had those moments. Everybody's had those moments, but it's how you act after them of what you do to understand your mistakes. Are they and use them as teachable moments, true learning experiences, and make sure the damn thing never happens again. That's how most people react.
Right.
So
but
this
not him.
Is important, not him. He did the exact opposite and he just carried on showing complete reckless disregard for people's lives and for the women around him, the way he treated Kimberly and Wendy. And the Wondery podcast talked about Kimberly breaking it up with him, but they characterized it by saying it wasn't a smooth breakup. Well, they're not the words I would choose to use to describe what happened when someone's banging down your door at 2 a.m. in the morning and he clearly has control issues. Now, whether it is stalking and there's more behaviours, and I would imagine there were, but I would certainly not describe it as just the breakup didn't go smoothly. This is somebody who acts when rejected, acts out, is abusive, lashes out, and he did the same with Wendy, who separated from him too, who had lived with him for many years, and he actually physically hit her and stole the baby. So again, we're getting more insights to that context of the things that he writes, how he treats women, how he also treats other people around him, but women in particular, I think, is very important. His cheating on both of them. And again, in the podcast, they say very diplomatically, he kept the two women apart. You know, his cheating on them is horrific character flaws and traits. This man has zero integrity, and I think at times they've been rather generous in their descriptors.
Right. I think that if we, at some point, want to measure him up against the psychopathy checklist, I don't think either of us will be surprised at the outcome, but we'll save that for another event. So let's talk about the case itself. They ended up actually prosecuting him for and convicting him of assault of the elderly, because in that particular state, they have the ability to put somebody in jail for life as a result of assaulting someone, I believe it was over the age of 65. And so that was actually the biggest hammer that they could use. And he was convicted of that. But he's appealing, isn't he?
He is, yes. He was charged with, it was 5 counts of aggravated assault, which again, interesting charges, given that when I talked about Dr. Harold Shipman, he was charged with murder. And that's the only case in the UK. It might even be the only case in the world. I don't know. But it seems that there is this big struggle, big battle once it comes to doctors. But 5 counts of aggravated assault against Jeff Cheney, Jennifer Rich, Jeff Glidewell, and Mary Erford. But he was convicted only of one, as you mentioned, Jim, which again is hugely problematic because of the appeal, because being convicted of one rather than five, it looks like it could well be, and I hate this phrase anyway, an isolated incident, i.e. it's just a one-off, and people lose the context of everything we've just discussed, which is really important. It's like the Weinstein case, the Cosby case. It's one of many. And I think that this is very problematic, the appeal, because they're trying to, the lawyer, his female lawyer, is trying to characterize it as it's a slippery slope problem of where do you draw the line if you charge and convict a doctor when, and it's her phrase that I use, when they are tap dancing on a razor blade of doing neurosurgery because it's such a risky business. So she's introducing the notion of this is a very dangerous area, and for the appeal judges to think very carefully in their decision about whether they warrant a new trial. And of course, well, we know that also the email that we just talked about was a very key part of the prosecution's case of talking to intent, that he intended to do this. Now, his lawyer is saying that that email had no place in the trial because it was irrelevant to Mary's case in particular. So that is a key legal argument that's being played out. So the legal arguments, you can see some merit to them if one case, Mary Erford's, is just seen in isolation and not in the context of either the 5 other victims or if not the other 33 out of 38. And bearing in mind just another context to layer in is that he had only ever done less than 100 surgeries. Now, when you place that against what Dr. Robert Henderson said, that you would expect someone of his qualifications and credentials to be in the ballpark of about 2,500. It also shows that he is incredibly inexperienced to be doing such high-level surgery. And I just hope all these things are being weighed in the balance in this appeal process, because the judges are deliberating currently, and who knows when they will make a decision. They've got a lot to consider. There's never been anything like it prior. So it's difficult to compare it in case law, but it's very concerning. And I would imagine they are deliberating very carefully. But I would really like to see more of those other cases. If there is a new trial, a prosecutor introducing those other cases in the similar way that the Cosby case and Weinstein cases were heard. I don't know what your view is on that, Jim, as a former prosecutor, what you think about that.
I think the biggest problem with appellate cases is that many times they turn on technicalities, not on the facts. In other words, the appeals court can't even consider the underlying facts of the case. They can only consider legal issues or procedural issues. And so whether or not he's successful on the appeal really has nothing to do with guilt or innocence. It has all to do with, did they follow all the procedures? Did they dot the I's and cross the T's? And unfortunately, that's one thing that, you know, it's most prosecutors are young lawyers who have an overwhelming caseload, who don't have a lot of extra time to think of all the little nuances. And when appeal lawyers are hired by defendants, they're typically these firms that have a lot of experience finding ways to punch holes in a case that may not have been badly done or intentionally messed up by the prosecutor, but they might be able to find something that they could drive a little bit of a hole through and then, you know, drive a truck through it and destroy the whole case. So all I know is that this guy maimed and killed people, and there's a chance that he could go out free. And those people that he maimed and the family members of the people he killed will never have their loved one back or their life back the way it was. And it's just completely unfair if he gets to walk.
Do you think there should be a finger of blame pointed at, you know, those oversight bodies that just let him go on and on and on, even though they knew what he was doing and they just did nothing? You know, to me, so many people could have been saved if when he was back at Baylor Hospital and he was first being whistleblown on, and they just did nothing. They just seemed like their hands were tied. So why do they even exist?
Well, that's the thing. You said it. You know, they seemed like their hands were tied. Or is it just that they didn't want to take the risk, or they didn't want to make doctors worry that people could come after him anytime and then have nobody want to be a doctor? Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there are plenty of good doctors who welcome the oversight, who welcome people looking at what they're doing. It's just when you have case after case after case, and again, like I said, this was 33 victims, 33 patients who had horrible outcomes or death in 2 months. That's 16 and a half a month. You know, that's basically one every other day. How do you not stop it after 5 or 10 of these? How do you not remove his license? How do you not review every single case to make sure this isn't a problem? I mean...
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing, that they were waiting for complainants to come forward. Like, they didn't bother going back to check on people he'd worked on.
Yeah, but they're not... As they say, they're not a proactive body, but
well,
what I would say is that I reject the notion this was a perfect storm. I reject that notion because you had Dr. Robert Henderson and Dr. Randall Kirby and others continuously raising the alarm. You had nurses raising the alarm. You had multiple people screaming loudly that there was a problem, and you had administrators continuing to ignore that there's a problem. And you have a Texas medical board who wait a year. Maybe they're doing things behind the scenes, but I don't think it's a coincidence that a journalist, Brad Shipp, then goes digging around. And at the very same time he's asking difficult questions, Dr. Randall Kirby writes the letter saying flat out he's dangerous. So I don't accept that this is a perfect storm. I'm very concerned about the lack of oversight. And I think that, unfortunately, the healthcare industry is rife and ripe for people to exploit others, unfortunately. Just today, there was another news headline about a gynecologist, Dr. Javid Pewat, who was convicted in federal court for performing unnecessary surgeries on people, including hysterectomies.
Women. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and convicted. And they put it down to it was all about greed, but he has destroyed countless women's lives by taking out their womb. And it just makes me so angry. It's so egregious. So I don't think there should be this malaise around, oh, well, it's the perfect storm, that people put it down to, oh, well, things were happening in the background. Because what's changed? Even from the Dr. Death season one, season two, what's actually changed? What's the learning opportunity? And what lessons have they actually taken as recommendations and put in place? Because from what I can tell, and maybe I'm wrong, and maybe our listeners can let us know, but from what I can tell, there doesn't seem to be any real thoughtful review to ensure that this never happens again. What there tends to be, and what I can see, is a lot of defensive action being taken, rather than thinking, well, how do we ensure this doesn't happen again? And that part is unacceptable. This isn't just a one-off case. There are multiple cases. And as you started this podcast, Lisa, quite frankly, it's terrifying for patients going to doctors, putting your trust in them. And I guess we should all be better at asking questions about what's going on. But these medical boards are there for that very reason, to stop people like Dunch from just going from hospital to hospital or state to state. It's the very reason they exist, to ensure public safety. So I think there are some real lessons there. And I don't feel inclined to let them off the hook and just say, oh, well, perfect storm, terrible case, move on to the next one.
Well said.
Right.
Regarding Jerry's outcome, you know, this isn't to say that people who are quadriplegic can't have full lives, you know, full of love and productivity. It just, in his case, it just really devastated him. And it doesn't seem like there's any way that he could ever recover fully.
He was always decapitated. When you put it in those terms, when people say it in layman's terms, rather
yes.
You realize just how serious these things are, of him just being allowed after multiple botched surgeries to do that to his friend and to never express or cry or say, I'm sorry, or show that he was upset. And Jerry, yes, situationally, he will be frustrated and act out. His whole life changed significantly and was told that he'd be in a nursing home forever. So, you know, I agree. I feel a lot of compassion. And even Jen knows that when he was using his wheelchair as a battering ram, it wasn't intentional. It was just frustration coming out. It's very different from a pattern of behavior where someone's trying to control another, which is what Dunch was doing in his relationships with women. So this is patterned stuff, absolutely egregious in every way. And we must remember that two women died. And that's where I would like to end, thinking about Kelly Martin, who died after surgery, as did Floella Brown. And they no longer have a voice because of the botched surgery, because of this man who failed to take any responsibility for what he did, and then he continued to maim so many others. So I'd like to end the episode thinking about all those that Dunch maimed, who he had an impact on their lives, but in particular, hashtag her name was Kelly Martin and hashtag her name was Floella Brown. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.